Welcome to the Security Nexus Deep Dive. Today we're tackling a really core dilemma in security and international relations. Zero-day diplomacy.
It boils down to a tough question, doesn't it? You find a powerful digital weapon, a flaw in software nobody knows about yet.
Exactly. Do you patch it up, protect everyone, or do you keep it secret, stockpile it, maybe use it against your adversaries?
It's this fundamental conflict between defense and offense, patching versus exploiting. And it really shapes how nations interact, how alliances work.
So our mission today is to unpack that. We're going to look at the U.S. government's approach, the Vulnerabilities Equities Process, or VEP.
Right, the internal policy fights there.
Then we'll zoom in on the individual researchers, the psychological barriers they face, using something called the VBD model.
Which has some really surprising findings.
And finally, we'll look at the strategic game theory, how alliances decide whether to share these vulnerabilities or hoard them.
Yeah, how those calculations play out at the highest levels. It's where tech, psychology, and, well, grand strategy all collide.
This deep dive comes to you from the Security Nexus. We're a Maryland-based national security consultancy focusing on strategic advice, education, and public engagement. Find out more at thesecuritynexus.net. Okay, let's dive in.
Let's start with the U.S. context then.
Right. So first off, what exactly is a zero day?
It's a vulnerability, a flaw in software or hardware that the vendor doesn't know about yet. So naturally, there's no patch, no fix available.
Making it incredibly valuable for attackers, for intelligence agencies.
Exactly. And Kellen Carlton's work points out this unique kind of tricky position the U.S. government is in.
How so?
Well, they're probably the biggest customer for these zero-day exploits in the world. They actively seek them out for intelligence for military purposes.
Okay.
But at the same time, they're also the entity most responsible for protecting the digital infrastructure, which relies heavily on the very software that might contain these flaws. You know, protecting U.S. citizens, businesses, allies.
So they want the weapon, but they also have to defend against it. That's a built-in conflict.
A huge conflict. And that's why the Vulnerabilities Equities Process, the VEP, was created back around 2008 under the Bush administration. It was classified for years.
Right, only unclassified in 2017. Yeah. So what does the VEP actually do?
It's the formal process, the mechanism, for deciding what to do with a discovered vulnerability. Does the government disclose it so it can be patched?
Protecting everyone.
Or do they keep it secret, restrict knowledge to use it for, you know, intelligence gathering, law enforcement, maybe military ops?
And who makes that call?
There's an equities review board, the ERB. It has people from Department of Justice, Department of Homeland Security, probably now the Director of National Intelligence, coordinated by the National Security Council.
Okay, so all the big players.
Yeah. And the official policy, the mandate, is supposed to lean towards disclosure. Patching is the default.
Supposed to be.
Right. Exploitation is only meant to happen if there's a, quote, demonstrable overriding interest in keeping it secret.
That sounds like a significant caveat. And, well, we know how this can go wrong, don't we? There's a pretty infamous example.
Oh, absolutely. Eternal Blue. It's the poster child for VEP failure.
Explain that one.
Okay. So Eternal Blue was a major vulnerability in Microsoft Windows software. The NSA apparently knew about it, possessed it, and were using it.
For how long?
Reportedly for almost 5 years. Kept it secret.
5 years. Wow. Until?
Until April 2017. That's when a group called the Shadow Brokers apparently stole a bunch of NSA cyber tools, including Eternal Blue, and just dumped them online.
The fallout was immediate.
Catastrophic. North Korea quickly weaponized it for the WannaCry ransomware attacks.
Which hit everywhere, right? I remember the UK's National Health Service was crippled.
Exactly. Hospitals shut down, massive disruption, billions in damages globally. And then Russia apparently used it for the NotPetya attacks, causing even more widespread commercial damage.
So the very tool the US kept secret for offense ended up being used against the U.S. and its allies by adversaries.
Precisely. It completely backfired. A stark example of the risks of stockpiling these things.
Okay, so that's government struggling with this offense-defense balance. Let's pivot now. What about the individual researcher, the person, maybe unaffiliated, who finds one of these flaws?
Yeah, that's crucial because incidents using these vulnerabilities are skyrocketing. Getting those independent discoveries reported is vital.
So how do we encourage that?
Well, this brings us to the work of Andrew William Green, DeJarvis Oliver, and Amy B. Wojcinski. They developed what they call the Vulnerability Discovery and Disclosure, or VDD model.
VDD model. What's the idea there?
It's interesting. It adapts the psychological theory called protection motivation theory, but it flips the usual approach.
Flips it how?
Usually, you try to get people to protect themselves by increasing their perception of a threat,
Yeah.
making them more scared.
Like, wear your seatbelt or else.
Exactly. But for vulnerability researchers, the VDD model suggests we need to do the opposite. We need to encourage reporting by lowering their fear specifically, their fear of negative consequences from reporting, while also increasing their sense of efficacy.
Efficacy, meaning like their belief that reporting will actually do some good.
Precisely. Their belief that they can make a difference and that the process is safe for them.
And do researchers have reason to be afraid?
Oh, definitely. The study found that something like 25% of researchers reported facing legal threats after disclosing a vulnerability.
A quarter of them. That's high.
It is. And U.S. laws like the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, CFAA, or the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, DMCA, are often seen as, well, chilling good faith research.
How so?
Because the way they're written, just finding a bug, even with good intentions, could potentially expose researcher to lawsuits, huge fines, reputational damage, even criminal charges.
So a huge disincentive to report anything.
A massive one. So the VDD model says the way forward is through clear vulnerability disclosure policies, VDPs.
Okay, what do those do?
Good VDPs offer researchers what's called safe harbor, basically a promise from the organization. If you follow these rules for reporting, we won't sue you or report you to law enforcement.
Ah, legal protection.
Yes. Plus, maybe some form of reward or recognition. But here's the kicker. The research found only about 20% of Fortune 500 companies actually have clear, easily findable VDPs.
Only 20%. So most researchers are operating in a legal gray area.
Pretty much flying blind, yeah.
Yeah.
But here's where the VDD survey got really interesting, almost counterintuitive. When they analyzed what actually motivated researchers to report, the factors related to the researcher's personal risk.
Like fear getting sued themselves.
Exactly. Fear of personal prosecution, fines, etc. Those factors actually failed to load significantly in the final statistical model. They dropped out.
Wait, really? They weren't primarily driven by their own
It
risks.
seems not, based on this study. But what did remain significant were factors related to the perceived threat severity to the organization.
So they were more motivated by how much damage the vulnerability could cause the company financial loss, reputation hit.
That's what the data suggests, that external researchers might be weighing the potential suffering of the organization more heavily than their own personal legal risk when deciding whether to report.
That's kind of altruistic, isn't it? An ethical consideration taking precedence.
It points that way, potentially. Maybe the sheer volume of cyber threats makes personal prosecution seem less likely. Or maybe there's a strong ethical component in that community. They see the potential harm and feel compelled to act.
Fascinating. So, if individuals are thinking about the organization's welfare, how does this scale up? How do nations, grouped in alliances, decide whether to share or hoard these digital weapons?
Right, that brings us to the strategic level, to the Cyber Alliance game or CAG model. This comes from Gjergj Benka and Gjergj Bikzok.
Cyber Alliance game, what does it model?
It specifically looks at that decision point for a nation state within an alliance. Do I exploit this vulnerability I found for my own gain, or do I share it with my allies?
And what influences that choice?
A key factor is the reward structure within the alliance. Specifically, what's the collective benefit? The reward, they call it RE, for sharing the vulnerability. If the reward for sharing is low for everyone, the model predicts an equilibrium where everyone just decides to attack individually. Attack, attack.
Which sounds dangerous. Lots of potential for escalation.
Exactly. It becomes a non-zero-sum game, but one tilting towards conflict. However, if the alliance offers high rewards for sharing,
And everyone shares.
then the incentive shifts, and you're more likely to get a share-share equilibrium. Cooperation becomes the rational, profitable choice. It promotes stability.
But alliances aren't all equal internally, are they? Power dynamics must matter.
They matter hugely. The CAG model actually incorporates ideas from weighted voting theory to classify members.
Weighted voting, like in shareholder meetings.
Sort of. They identify three types of players within an alliance based on their voting power: dictators, veto players, and dummy players.
Okay, break those down. Dictators.
A dictator is a member whose vote alone is enough to pass a resolution or whose vote is essential for any winning coalition. They have ultimate control.
Veto players.
A veto player can single-handedly block any resolution, but they can't necessarily pass one on their own. Their consent is needed.
And dummy players.
Dummy players have no real influence. Their vote never affects the outcome. either because they're never needed for a majority or they can never be part of a winning coalition.
Got it. So how do these roles affect the sharing decision?
Well, consider dictators dealing with other dictators. The model suggests they mostly choose to share.
Why? Wouldn't they want to keep the advantage?
Because they know that even after sharing within the alliance, they still retain control over the vulnerability's ultimate use due to their dictator status. Sharing with a co-controller is less risky than letting an outsider potentially use it against them without any control.
Okay, that makes sense. What about dummy players?
Dummy players facing other dummies, they almost always default to the attack-attack strategy. The alliance rewards for sharing are irrelevant to them.
Because
they know that once they share the vulnerability, they lose all influence over what happens next. They have no power. So their best bet is to try and exploit it themselves before someone else does, or before the alliance patches it.
That really highlights potential friction within alliances and veto players.
Veto players are the most sensitive to the reward and punishment structure. Their power comes from their ability to grant or withhold consent, so they respond strongly to the incentives the alliance sets up for sharing versus attacking.
So knowing the internal structure of an adversary's alliance gives you a huge advantage.
A massive predictive advantage, yes. You can better anticipate whether they're likely to share a capability internally or try to use it unilaterally based on who holds the power and what the incentives look like.
And alliances can actively shape these incentives, right, through policy.
Absolutely. They call it policy posture, AA. An alliance can deliberately tune its rules to encourage certain behaviors.
How does it work?
A defensively oriented alliance might apply a penalty for members launching individual attacks. So the payoff for attacking gets reduced, maybe multiplied by a factor like 0.8. This pushes members towards sharing.
Discouraging aggression.
Right. Conversely, an offensively oriented alliance might do the opposite. They could offer a reward multiplier for successful individual attacks, maybe multiplying the payoff by 1.2 or something.
Actively encouraging members to go on the offensive.
Exactly. And the model suggests different approaches work best for different player types. Dummy players who ignore rewards are best controlled by imposing strict penalties for attacking.
Make the downside really high.
Yes. But veto players, being more strategic, are more effectively influenced just by adjusting the overall reward punishment, balance the policy posture itself.
Okay, this connects the technical vulnerability to high-level strategy. Let's take it one step further. How does this idea of vulnerability itself play out in international discourse?
That's where we bring in work by Alexandra Hommeler and Oliver Turner. They look at how vulnerability isn't just a technical state, but it's used as a political narrative, a cultural trope, even a policy mechanism.
A narrative. How so?
Well, think about the dominant narrative used by many Western alliances, the idea of the rules-based order, or RBO.
Okay, we hear that term a lot.
Hommeler and Turner argue that this RBO narrative is a kind of collective story. It defines who's in the group, who shares values, and crucially, it often works by emphasizing the RBO's own vulnerability.
Vulnerable to what?
Usually vulnerable to perceived threats from antagonists like China or Russia are often framed. The shared sense of being under threat, of being vulnerable.
It builds cohesion within the alliance.
Exactly. It reinforces a shared purpose, a sense of us versus them. And it provides a ready-made justification, a pretext for political action, condemnation, or intervention against those perceived threats. The narrative of vulnerability becomes a strategic tool itself.
And does this narrative have to be, well, strictly accurate?
That's the interesting part. They argue the RBO narrative is often quite ambiguous. This flexibility allows member states like the U.S. or Australia to frame their own actions, even controversial ones, as necessary steps to defend this vulnerable order.
So claiming victimhood or vulnerability grants moral authority, even when you might be acting aggressively.
It can function that way, yes. Mm-hmm. The narrative of vulnerability becomes a powerful tool for justification and maintaining alliance unity, independent of the technical realities of specific flaws.
Wow. Okay, so let's try and synthesize this. We've covered a lot of ground.
We have. Three distinct but connected layers, really.
First, at the government level, the US VEP shows this constant, difficult friction between offense and defense, with Eternal Blue as a tragic cautionary tale.
Then down at the individual researcher level, the VDD model surprisingly showed us it's often ethics, the concern for the organization's suffering that drives reporting, highlighting just how vital trust and legal safe harbors are.
Right. And finally, zooming out to the alliance level, the Cyber Alliance game revealed how internal power structures, dictator, veto, dummy roles, and the policy incentives dictate whether these powerful 0 days get shared or hoarded.
Yeah, the big takeaway seems to be that vulnerability, whether it's in software code or in the narrative of the international order, is never just a passive condition.
Actively managed.
Actively managed, manipulated, leveraged, exploited, really, for strategic gain across policy, business, and global politics.
Which leaves us with a final thought for you, our listeners, to mull over. Think about this pervasive emphasis we see everywhere today on vulnerability.
Vulnerability in software, in our critical infrastructure, in the global order itself.
To what extent does highlighting all this vulnerability serve not only the genuine need for security and protection, but also, perhaps more subtly, function to justify new forms of governance, new controls over individuals, markets, maybe even entire alliances?
It's a deep question, something to really chew on. We absolutely need to thank the researchers whose work underpin this discussion. Andrew William Green, DeJarvis Oliver, Amy B. Wojcinski, Gergely Benker, Gergely Bikasok, Kellen Carlton, and Alexandra Homelar and Oliver Turner. Their insights were invaluable.
Indeed. Thank you for joining us for the Security Nexus Deep Dive. To continue exploring these critical intersections of technology, policy, and strategy, please visit us at thesecuritynexus.net.